Welcome to episode number 8 of Become a Guitarist Today podcast with myself, Adam Roach. In this podcast, I am joined with Jennifer Batten from the Michael Jackson Band and also Jeff Beck. We talk about how she first got into GIT, the Guitar Institute. We also talk about how she got her first audition for the Michael Jackson Band. She talks about her time touring with Michael all around the world. And she also demonstrates some great warm-up exercises for the guitar. You can also pre-order her new album coming out September 22nd. So head on over to her website in the links to find out more information. So let's go over to the interview with Jennifer Batten. Hello there.
Hey.
How are you?
Doing all right.
That's good.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for doing the podcast for me.
Sure.
So basically what I've done, I've got a little timeline of your history so far. So I just wanted to go through a few things and go from there, if that's okay.
Yeah. Let's rock and roll.
All right. So let's start in 1966 when you were 8 years old.
Okay.
When you first started playing. So can you just tell us about that, how you first started getting into it and some of your influences?
Yeah, well, my main influence was my sister because she had a guitar and it was in my face and it wasn't mine. So I was very jealous and wanted one of my own. So the next Christmas, my parents got me an electric, which at that time was pretty rare to give a kid an electric for the first guitar. Mm. And at the same time, the Beatles were starting to explode in America. So the combination of the two, it's almost like I didn't have a choice but to become a guitar player.
Yeah. So is there any favorite Beatles songs that come into your mind that you really heard that thought, ooh, sounds pretty cool for guitar?
You know, I don't think I was really zoned in to the actual guitar at that point. I just heard the song as a chunk of energy.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, the first records, Love, Love Me Do, that's when you're 8 years old, that kind of melody is enough to fill your life up.
Yeah, definitely. So you first started, so you had a teacher or a couple of teachers?
Yeah, I started right away. My dad got us lessons. Actually, my first lesson was with my sister. And years later, after I've been teaching guitar, I look back and feel sorry for the teacher, you know, because as my dad was behind us and my sister and myself and the teacher was dealing with all of that.
Yep.
And I remember I felt it was really traumatic because he was trying to get me to read notes and use a pick, and it was just all too much for me, and I cried.
Yeah.
So fortunately, after that, I ended up on one-on-one lessons and learned to read off the basic books right off the bat.
Yep.
So that, gosh, I think that's all I ever did with that teacher was going from lesson to lesson in one of the Alfred's books,
the
popular book. And then when I was 9, the family moved to California, and I ended up with a different teacher, and then we had rented a house for a year, then I moved to another part of town, so I ended up with another teacher, and it was all really cool because each teacher had something very, very different to show me, from finger-picking techniques to blues, comping, to you name it. So it really held my interest over the years.
So you learned like a few different styles from the different teachers?
Yeah, really good, especially to get my right hand doing the finger picking thing early on. And I just naturally have used that ever since in whatever I'm doing. So, it all adds to whatever is in the gray matter at this point.
Yeah. Now, before I go on to the next question, I need to ask you a very important question.
Yeah.
Can you please play me a G major 7th chord?
Yeah, I'll do it with lots of distortion. That'll sound great.
Hey, you're in.
I put that together.
So I guess you know what's coming up now. Your first audition for GIT?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that, your first one when you didn't get in?
Yeah. Well, they had advertised when they were just getting off the ground and didn't have that many students. They advertised a big weekend symposium in Hollywood, and I was living 100 miles south in San Diego at the time. So I went up for the weekend and just got blown away, one teacher after another, all these jazz monsters, going off of Tommy Tedesco was talking about studio and reading, and Howard Roberts, who was the guy that wrote the curriculum for the school, and he was big in the session scene. Jackie King, Mundell Lowe, Joe DiOrio, Don Mock, all these people would give clinics, and most of it was over my head, but it was intriguing enough that I took a test just to see if I could get in before the weekend was over, and nope. No, I had taken lessons for all those years, but I didn't know the basic tools. So they sent me south, and I ended up studying with this great jazz guitar player named Peter Sprague. Yeah. It was really, really intense. He got me caught up with the tools, learning chord scales and, you know, harmonic minor and doing scale patterns, stuff that I had never done before, and also learning solos. He was really into Chet Baker at the time, so I was learning trumpet solos on guitar. And I remember I brought in a Hendrix tune that I wanted to learn, and his vibe was so not into it that was my one attempt at getting into rock with him. So basically stuck with jazz for 6 months, and it was enough knowledge, and I practice a lot every day, so I got into the school 6 months later.
Yeah, so you're definitely improved by then in that 6 months.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So
would that be right saying 1979 is that when you got in?
I graduated in March 79, so
I graduated. Okay.
A year earlier. It was the third class they ever had. They would bring people in every 6 months.
Yep. Okay, gotcha. Now, so when you were at GIT, you were staying in a friend's garage, is that right?
Yeah. I look back and I think, oh my God, I could never do that again. You know, I had a little Bunsen burner. I would have this horrible slop on toast. That was my dinner.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah. But I'm really grateful. I had it for free for a year. Mm. It was just part of a garage. It was a very small place, just enough. It had a toilet and a bed and a sink. So I had to go into their house to shower.
Yeah.
And it was a good hour away from school, but I did it for a year.
So how long was the course at GIT?
It was a year long.
Oh, just 1 year.
I don't know how many years later they took the same curriculum and stretched it out to a year and a half because they were starting to lose people. Because it was so intense, man. If you take a vacation for a week, you're so far behind. Forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, it was all I could do to keep up with the curriculum. It was full time. And I don't know how people could keep a job and do that. And I was lucky enough I didn't have to. I just did school 24/7.
Yeah, definitely. Because I remember when I was, you know, back then playing as well, and I saw it in the guitar playing magazines advertised, and I really looked into it. But I mean, being in Australia, it's a bit hard as well getting over there. But yeah, the things I read on it, it's like you said, it's pretty full on, and you got to be very dedicated and got to have the money support behind you as well, I guess.
Well, you know how much the school cost that year?
How much?
I'm going to you guess.
Oh, let's see, 2,000.
Wow, that's close. I think it was $2,400 or $2,600 an entire year.
Wow.
Now it's, I don't know, $50,000.
Is it really?
Like a regular university. Oh, it's very expensive now.
Wow. So now it's the MIT, isn't it?
Just MI.
Oh, is it?
Okay. MIT is actually, I think, an engineering school on the East Coast, but even a lot of graduates call it MIT just because it's such a well-known group of lecturers.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was only guitar, GIT.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so when you're there, you're teaching as well? When you finished the course?
Yeah, it was a couple of years later. Let's see, I graduated in 79 and went back. I moved back to San Diego and got some stage chops, started playing with bands.
Yep.
And went back to L.A. in 1984.
Oh, okay.
Started teaching maybe late 84, 85. Finally got the Michael Jackson tour in 1987.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about that phone call you had for the audition. So how'd that come about?
It was a series of phone calls. Actually, at that time, Musicians Institute now had guitar, bass, drums, and maybe even vocals, and they had a referral department. So people would call them looking for players, and luckily, one of Michael's guys called the school and asked them to send two players.
Yep.
And I was one of the lucky winners. Well, I came home from, I think I was teaching somewhere else that day, and had a three messages from the same person saying, I got an audition for you. And the next one is, where the hell are you? And the third one was like, all right, I'll tell you. It's for Michael Jackson. Call me back immediately. Yeah, pretty exciting. So I got in touch with these people and got a list of songs to learn. And when I went in there, there was no band. It was just me and a video camera. Which, ultimately, I think that was more relaxing and I could really do my thing rather than worrying about forms of a song and being all stiff and nervous. At that time, I was in five or six different bands, and in most of them, because it was the Van Halen era at that time, I think every guitar player in every band had a solo spot. Yeah. You know? So I was used to doing that. The only guidance I was given was to play some funk rhythm.
Okay.
Rather, so I improvised something, then I started soloing, ended up doing the Giant Steps tapping solo that ended up on my first record. And then I ended the Beat It solo because I had been playing that in a cover band for a couple of years. And I thought, yeah, I'd find that useful.
Yeah, that's handy.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure that's what sold it.
Yeah. Now, is there anything you remember from the audition that you could play now? Just a little bit?
Oh, gosh.
Well, put you on the spot.
I don't remember that. I might have done a little Flight of the Bumblebees. Something like that. But mostly it was just soloing. And let's see, let me get a clean sound up here. I think I started out with that. It's a Jeff Beck funk rhythm. When they said, we want you to show some funk because that's going to be 90% of what you do. Yeah. You know, even though I was kind of hired for 16 bars, there's two more hours to the show.
So how long was the actual whole video, like the audition?
I'm guessing 15 minutes max.
Oh, okay.
And at the end, they wanted me to, well, Michael wanted to get a sense of your personality. So, boom, you got a video on you. And that was the hardest part of the audition. It wasn't like I was asked questions. It's just like, tell me about yourself. You know? I like furry animals. I actually saw my audition 2 years ago.
Really?
There's a guy named Steve Swirsky that's doing a documentary on female guitar players.
Oh, wow.
He ended up hooking up with the guy that shot that video, and he still had it.
Ah.
Or is enough all these years later to still have it.
Yeah.
It's 30 years now, right? 87.
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny. I was such a geek. I mean, I'm still a geek, but it wasn't how I remembered it.
Yeah.
But I bunch of tapping, and there was a note that Michael made next to everybody's name, and he put a star and wrote great. So 30 years later to see that was obviously he liked something about it because I got hired, but it was a extra special fun thing to see that.
Yeah. So will that be released in the video he's doing, not the film?
He's trying to find distribution. I think it's close to done now. He's shown it at a few kind of indie festivals, but you can't buy it yet.
No.
It's called She Rocks.
Okay. But that audition will be on there, will it?
I imagine he'll cut some in, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a scary thought.
That'll be good to see.
there's some good stuff on it.
Yeah. So it takes us to 1987, when you started the Bad Tour
with
Michael Jackson. So that must have been a big change, going from the original bands, you know, six bands, to this big, 123 concerts, to 4.4 million fans?
Well, I never retain numbers, but I'm sure you research. I mean, the first tour, we were out for a year and a half.
Mm.
So it was like a paid vacation.
Yep.
You know, most tours they're so expensive to put on that there's no days off. If there's a day off, it's traveling to the next venue. So, and I remember asking his manager at that time, or I don't know if I asked him or he just volunteered the information, that it cost $500,000 every week to keep us on the road.
Jeez.
Most bands would go bankrupt in 1 week.
Yeah.
But there was 100 people in the entourage, and typically 40 to 60 to 80,000 people paid tickets every time we played. So, you know, he was the biggest star in the world, so it wasn't all that hard to sell it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he'd been touring his entire life, and finally he was worth enough money that he could not kill himself.
Yeah.
You know, he could, we did 2 or 3 shows a week. Yeah. So we had plenty of time to recuperate. I mean, there wasn't much recuperating for us. We were just having a good time, but Michael was working hard, and the dancers too. There's a lot of energy to put out in the show. And he nailed it night after night.
Yeah, for sure. So how much rehearsal was there before the concert, before the tour, sorry?
There was a lot. In the beginning, it was divided between 3 rooms, the band without Michael, dancers, and singers.
Mm.
And we worked on our own for a solid month. And a lot of it was programming sounds. Even with the drums, he had a rack of stuff he had to trigger.
Yep.
You know, like that snare on Billie Jean. Everybody, whether they realize it or not, they heard that song enough that they know the EQ on that snare. And especially starting with Bad, the sounds on that. I mean, even Thriller, there's a ton of really identifiable sounds. But some of the snares starting on Bad, he would just layer all these things that just sounded like a, you know, nuclear explosion. So there's no way a drummer with a regular snare is going to get that. So Ricky had a whole lot of stuff to trigger. And that's when I got into guitar programming too, to get the, you know, exact delays of the tempo of the song. And that was my first rack. I mean, everybody was into racks at that time.
Yeah.
And I went from having a few pedals to a rack the size of a refrigerator. It was really daunting at first.
Yeah. So what was your most challenging song to learn out of all that whole set?
I think it was Thriller, and in part because it's got the most chord changes.
Mm.
And in Man in the Mirror, there's a lot of stuff going on too, but Thriller, and then it seemed like every day Michael would come in and want to change the key.
Oh, really?
It's one thing to change the key with a simple song, but something like that, you're going, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Backstage and, you know, to get it together. Usually he would tell the musical director that he wanted to try something new, so we'd have a little time before Michael showed up to get up to speed.
So that must have been hard. I mean, especially, I'd say, mainly for the guitar, really, change keys like that, especially if you've got a lot of open riffs. And
yeah, Thriller was... I don't think there's anything open in that as far as the chords.
Mm.
Something like Beat It, you know, if I had to transpose a solo, that would just suck. But having said that, we did it in C.
Oh, really?
So I had a special guitar tuned down to C, which had ridiculously thick strings. You know, you play in one action, one feel all night, and then my big 16 bars, I had this Frankenstein guitar that I had to deal with. And the first time... They had me in a different costume every tour for Beat It.
Mm.
But the first time they were checking out the fiber optic lights that run my hair, it was indoors at the rehearsal hall, and they turned out all the lights, and I couldn't see my frets. So that was a real struggle. And after that, I got glow-in-the-dark tape. And so I keep that on hand. I keep that in my guitar case because you never know what situations you're going to run into where you really need to see your frets.
Yeah. I guess what would be challenging is the stabs and the stops, you know, due to the dancing. Would that be more challenging than the actual playing itself?
You know, I was into a lot more advanced kind of music and harmonies at the time I got that gig. So the challenge was the groove.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I worked my butt off learning the parts and memorizing those and spent a lot of time getting that together. But I remember at one point, Greg Fellingham, he would always join the tour a little late or join the rehearsals a little late. So I think we rehearsed for at least a week before he came in.
Yeah.
In fact, I was even showing him the form to Billie Jean because it's a little quirky.
Yeah.
He's a very quick study, but he wasn't sure about that when he showed up. But after we had played through everything a couple times, he goes, okay, now let's focus on groove. I didn't grow up with funk.
Yeah.
I grew up with a whole other radio. So it was good. And he was such a kind guy. You hear stories about big tours where a rookie gets on board and gets their ass kicked, which is really unnecessary. You know, if you've got the skills, just a little coaching can get you up to speed. Yeah. We were all really blessed to have him at the helm. It's the music wasn't really difficult. It wasn't like learning Coltrane's Giant Steps or something. Mm. But it's nailing the parts, nailing every little detail, every little nuance. It was such a valuable thing to be rehearsing that much. And I did say we rehearsed for a month, and then there was a whole other month with Michael on a big sound stage. Mm. So that's where they put the choreography and special effects and all that together. And I'll tell you, man, it's been 30 years, and I've played with a hell of a lot of bands since then of all different levels and really great musicians. And invariably, people don't get the details right. Yeah. It doesn't matter what level it is. It really takes a lot of concentration and awareness to really nail the details of what was on the record.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other skill. And now there's no excuse for it, because there's a software that I recommend to everybody called Transcribe.
Yeah, I saw that. I was going to ask you about that one.
Yeah, it's just a godsend. I mean, back in the day before digital, I had these cassette decks that you could manipulate the motor and turn it down in octaves to slow everything down.
Yeah.
But then you had to transpose it back up.
And
sometimes I would send it through a harmonizer and an EQ, just trying to really hear the chord voicings and stuff. And it was a lot of effort. And now with this software Transcribe, yeah, I mean, you can instantly slow things down, keep it in the same key. And it has some presets for EQ, and one I use all the time is called Bass Remove.
Okay.
So I'll hit that, it'll remove the bass, and it also has karaoke mode, which removes, takes the center track out of phase if it's a stereo thing. And, you know, all you have left, basically, is the keyboard, guitar frequencies, and drums. So you can really be a scientist, slow it down, and really dig in there and find out exactly what's going on. A lot of times your ears play tricks on you. Depending on the mix, you could hear something that you think is guitar that isn't really guitar until you can get in there and slow it down and really figure it out. And I found also a lot of times that if you learn something and it's extremely difficult, it's probably because you're not playing it right. It's probably you know, somebody did a detuning that makes it easy where you just put your finger straight across, and where before we were trying to do this kind of thing, couldn't get any more help than what is available in that app. And plus it has a kind of an automatic speed coach called Speed Trainer. So for instance, you could take a, you know, two bars if you wanted to of a really fast thing, slow it down to 25%, and tell the Speed Trainer to do the loop, and every time it loops around to increase the speed by 1%, or 2%, or whatever you choose. And it's so slight that you don't even realize that you're improving. But every time you repeat, it's like the synapse is connecting in your brain more and more and more, and until you have it nailed.
That's amazing. That's great.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's a phenomenal learning tool. And you know, I've done a lot of studying about how the brain learns. And basically, it's a big hard drive. And I've had enough students that I know guitar players are notorious for wanting to play something up to speed immediately. And the thing is, if you try it and make mistakes, you're programming mistakes. So I tell everybody, take small chunks, play it slow, play it perfectly, and then edge the speed up. And if you edge the speed up and make a mistake, you got to take the speed back down again. And that will get your programming correct, so that when you're up to speed, you nail it every time.
I mean, that would have been great to have back in the day, you know, when first learning the songs. I mean, I know when I was trying to learn El Dimeola riffs, for example, you had to like slow the tape down or try and just do it bit by bit. But something like that would be amazing.
Yeah, that's the one regret in my life is to not have Transcribe when I was 20 years old.
Yeah, that's really good. I have to look into that more. So you still got students now, don't you?
I don't really have any regular students for any length of time because I travel and tour a lot.
Okay.
And so momentum gets lost. You know, I might have somebody for a couple months and I Skype from somewhere in the world, and then I'm gone for 2 months and you know, when I get back, I'm just destroyed. So I don't reach out to them. They got to reach out to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I do a lot of clinics, but not that much on the one-on-one.
Now, going back to 1987, when you toured Australia, do you have any memories from that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's one of my favorite places, and I haven't been there in many years now. For one, it's comfortable because of the language.
Yeah.
You know, I remember times in Germany where it was just so difficult to try to get a meal. So being in an English-speaking country was really great. Weather was great, of course. And I'm really into exotic things like the Aboriginal thing.
Yeah.
I remember we went there, gosh, I think we went there every tour. And on the last tour, I was reaching out to the locals and I said, I'd really like to see an Aboriginal show.
Yep.
And I remember somebody said, well, they don't like to play for white people, so good luck with that.
No, really.
And I swear to God, in the week that followed, I saw three shows. For one thing, some people came to our catering tent and performed. The Michael Jackson thing.
Yeah.
And I had a boyfriend at the time, and we rented a Harley on one day off and went out into the outback, and there was a big sign saying Aboriginal show at 3 o'clock. And we go, zoom, we're there. That I love that. That was really exotic, and the ocean is beautiful. I think, you know, on the bad tour, we only stayed on the East Coast, so it wasn't until at least the Dangerous, maybe the History Tour before we got to Perth. And that, it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it.
Actually, I had in my notes here, in 1997, one of your solo albums, you had the didgeridoo on there. So is that someone from Australia?
You know, that was a sample from something else. I won, like a regular tourist would do, and my dogs can't stand it. So that's still hanging on the wall, unplayed.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually had one of our tracks in our original band. We started off with a didge. We had a friend come down and play, and it was...
That's a real skill.
Yeah, it is.
You know, they try to get you to put the straw in the water and do the circular breathing thing. And, oh, man, I lost patience very quickly.
Yeah. So also about that time, about 1989, when you were in the guitar magazine for practicing, and they were also talking about how you're practicing all the time. And so back then, how long were you practicing for?
Oh, God. You know, there's different length of time in different parts of my life. And when I graduated GIT, I did maybe 8 or 10 hours a day.
Mm.
They had you use an egg timer for different things. And for instance, you know, work on this G7 arpeggio for 5 minutes and then bing, go on to this. And it just really forced you to focus or you'd get way, way behind. And I didn't keep it up that intensely after, but I would do an hour of sight reading, an hour of ear training, an hour of arpeggios, an hour of scale patterns, and just keep going for 8 or 10 hours. And eventually, I would have an hour of jamming to some track, and then that was the fun part. So I'd reset the timer and do another hour, and then another hour. And then as I started to gig, I'd spend way more time learning songs and jamming to the solo sections of those.
Yeah.
When I was on the Jackson tour, we did get a lot of time off. And especially in America, after I had been to Europe and seen all these exotic things, we come to America and it's boring as hell.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be in hotels that were not close to anything. Yeah. So there's nothing to do but practice.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time in my days, you know, getting room service and practicing when we weren't having the show. So I, you know, I don't know. I didn't have an egg timer at that point, and I don't know how many hours I put in, but I was pretty dedicated until life took over. And now I don't have any special regimen. It's just like right now I've got sessions.
Yeah.
People send me tunes to play. And so I like to spend a couple days on those, just jamming to the solo section and getting familiar with the song before I record, and that's my day.
Yeah. So with those ones, like a lot of those sessions, they just send you the track and say, just go for it, or they've got like a special thing in mind to say, can you do this, do that?
Usually it's go for it. Here's the solo section.
Yeah.
Sometimes they want a lot more. They want me to add parts. There was one I did a month ago or so that I gave them so much to choose from, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, because it was just something that inspired me. And I go, well, I could do this, but I could do that, but I could do that.
Yeah.
And I just laid it all down and let them choose as far as guitar parts. But for the most part, it's we have a solo section and play the tag out as well.
Yeah. So, sorry, back to 1992, when you released your first solo album, Above, yeah. Below and Beyond. Yeah, so how'd that go, that album? Like, that was in the middle of the tours, wasn't it?
That was torture. I actually did 4 demo songs at Michael Sembello's studio. He's the guy that co-wrote Maniac, big hit in the 80s.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I did 4 tunes, and then I got the Jackson tour. So I didn't do anything else for a year and a half and picked it up after the tour was over.
Yep.
And it was just torture because I had so much momentum. I wanted to get this done and out, and I was, you know, working on the stuff at home as much as I could. And night after night, I got the crap hours because I had the crap budget, you know. he had a rapper at the same time I was recording named Gerardo. That was one of the first, well, it was the first signing of Interscope Records. And so they had like $1 million to put into it because they were going to make sure it was a success. So they got all the primo hours, and I was scheduled for midnight, and night after night, I wouldn't even start till 3 or 4 in the morning.
No, wow.
But most days were canceled. My memory is extremely frustrating.
Yeah.
And I think it took from beginning to finish was 3 years.
Jeez.
and in between times, I'd go off on the road to do a clinic tour or something, then I'd come up and pick it back and finally got it done. In fact, I sent myself to Hawaii when it was finally done.
I did. Yeah.
Deserved this vacation.
Yeah, why not? Because that same year you did the Dangerous tour with Michael Jackson as well. So I guess you wouldn't have had much time to really promote your own, would you? Your own album?
Oh, au contraire. it worked really well because my first record was done and finished just before the Dangerous tour.
Yeah.
So, you know, on Michael's dime, I would end up in all these different countries, and I had enough money to hire a publicist.
Okay.
On show days, I mean, I don't think we would leave the hotel till 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So I had them all mornings to do interviews.
Yeah.
And it was especially helpful that Michael didn't do interviews because they wanted to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
So I'd say, hey, sign me up. So I got tons and tons of press for that. But unfortunately, the record company I had didn't have much going on in Europe. Semi-wasted because it was before the internet, so people couldn't just click and get the album.
Yeah.
And it wasn't in the stores. So that was one of many, many lessons about the music business that is not so pleasant.
Yeah.
And then my next record, Momentum, I was just finishing the mixes when I got the History tour.
Yeah.
So that was really stressful, trying to get that done before everything took off. It was just crazy. But again, I was able to use the tour to promote the record.
Yeah. And people can still get your albums now, can't they, on your website? Those two
albums? Yeah. It's all on iTunes. And I have another one coming out with a fantastic singer named Mark Scheer.
Yeah, I saw that. That sounds great. A little promo.
It's really, really different for me. I only ended up co-writing one song on the record because I was brought in at the 11th hour to do some solos.
Mm.
And I flew to Chicago and had a great time. I was there for 2 days, and we recorded like 5 songs and wrote a song in that amount of time. And then they had me come back again, and then Mark called me up after that and said, you know, you've really changed the flavor of the record so much that I want you to be a bigger part of it.
Okay.
So now, when you see the record, it has both of our names and Battle Zone. And it's out September 22nd. There's a couple singles that are out now. It's up for pre-order as of last Friday. So I'm excited about that because it's been a really long time since I had a record out. Because I've kind of got really negative with the digital thing. My last record, I did everything at home, but still to get it properly mixed and mastered was maybe $12,000.
Yeah.
To spend that much money and then know that anybody could steal it, you'll never see them back.
Yeah.
I lost interest in recording.
Mm.
So this was kind of done instantly for me.
It sounds great. I mean, his voice and your guitar playing, what I've heard of it, you know, only got 3 minutes of it, but it sounds fantastic.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah, can't wait to hear the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I hope we get to take it out on the road because it is a real quality product. And a lot of the songs were written by Jim Peterik from Survivor.
Okay.
So, it's really, really fat stuff. A lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. Now, also back to 93, when you were about 35, you did the Super Bowl. Now, I've got here, there's been different things on there saying 1.3 billion or 1.5 billion. But anyway, there's a lot of people watching that.
Yeah.
So it must have been a little bit nerve-wracking.
You know, I will say it's the only time I ever felt that Michael was nervous. Mm. I mean, can you imagine that pressure?
Yeah.
If anything's wrong, it's there forever. There's no redos. It's live.
Yeah.
For me, it was just exciting. It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience that I'll never experience again, most likely.
Yeah.
And knowing how many people were watching, it was, for me, it was just fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny because I was the same as the rest of the band, where we weren't told anything that was going to happen other than our parts. So when it fired up and there was an impersonator on the scoreboard and a big puff of smoke and then another one on the other side, we didn't know that was going to happen.
Oh, really?
If you go back and look at that tape, you see me in the background going, whoa! Like, whoa! And I didn't know the kids were going to be there with signs at the end.
Yeah.
It was a big fun surprise and so different from the tour. I mean, I loved the tour. It was really fun, but it was just so different and interesting. It was a gas.
Yeah, good. So now let's go back to 97, the History Tour. So that was your last tour with Michael, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I can't remember. You know, the tours just kind of blend together, but yeah. I just remember the ending of it just not being great. There wasn't any big blowout like, yeah, we did this. We've been out for a year. It might have been the Dangerous Tour that we went to Istanbul and there was some jacked up stuff that happened. Mm. Apparently, we Americans accidentally sunk one of the Turkish ships just prior to Michael landing. And next thing we know, Michael's in London with a throat problem and we were told that the show was going to be postponed a couple of days.
Yeah.
And so we all believed it. And then a couple of days later, all of a sudden we get flights and we're out of there.
Yeah.
And that's the tour.
Oh,
you know, what a letdown. We were supposed to go to Greece after that. And I've still never been to Greece. Overall, it was such a blessing to it. What a wonderful way to see the world.
Oh, yeah.
It was our life savings just to spend 2 weeks in Rome.
Yeah.
You know, I got to see the entire planet and get paid for it. So, I have no regrets.
Yeah. So did you play with Michael anytime after that tour?
No, it was just all of his solo tours. And when he was gearing up for the thing in London, he was going to use Orianti. Well, the Aussie.
Yeah.
So obviously that whole thing blew up and didn't happen.
Mm.
But I mean, I never took it for granted that after the bad tour, he was going to ask me back again.
Yeah.
I thought, well, he's got a group of people for one tour and then a new tour with new faces. And so each time I got asked to go out, it was like, oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
It really is like a paid vacation.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was a fan of his music anyway. And to be part of it, be part of something that huge was amazing. And I remember George Lynch was in Japan, maybe in the bad tour. And he came and saw one of the shows. And he said, God, it must be amazing to be part of a tour like this. And it kind of stunned me because I thought, well, you're in a big band that's hugely successful with Dokken. And
yeah.
It really set the perspective because in reality, that's a whole different level.
Yeah.
I mean, Michael, just for costumes for the bad tour, spent $1 million. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
incredible.
That doesn't happen too often.
Yeah,
for sure. An act can afford to do something like that.
So overall, it was a great experience. The Michael Jackson days, the 10 years.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really fascinating spending time with players at that level.
Mm.
Like Greg Gaines, I think he started touring with Stevie Wonder when he was 17. He's like a child prodigy.
Yeah.
His mother told me he was taking tunes off the radio when he was 4 years old.
Wow.
He's one of those guys that could just play anything.
Yeah.
And severely gifted. Ricky Lawson on drums. To get used to that groove over time, you don't really realize how much you're improving and getting better
Yeah.
When you play with a band that isn't there. Yeah. You go, wow, now I see the difference. You know?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Did you get in contact with the other guys or any time in between the tours?
We have stayed in touch. Okay. The people in the band tour, yeah. It was such a monumental event everywhere it went that there was serious bonding from all of us.
Oh, for sure.
Unfortunately, from those tours, two people are dead now. Ricky Lawson passed away a couple of years ago, and David Williams a couple of years before that. Mm-hmm. So the last time we all got together was we had kind of a private memorial for Ricky by ourselves in L.A. But we still stay in touch from time to time through email. Yeah, it was such a good vibe, and we all dug each other, which doesn't always happen.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Big tours, and you get people that are hired from all walks of life, and I think more times than not, people don't get along.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So that takes us to 99, time of Jeff Beck. That would have been amazing.
Yeah, I guess that's when I started, 99, yeah.
Mm. So how was that compared to what you've been through with Michael Jackson tours to go to Jeff Beck? Different vibe?
Yeah, it was night and day different, really. Mm. Jeff had been a hero of mine, gosh, since I was a teenager, since I first heard Blow by Blow on the radio.
Yeah.
And so he was such an icon. And before the internet, you really had to do some digging to find out anything about anybody. And to get bootlegs, I'd spend hours in bootleg shops going through things. And, you know, compared to a band like Led Zeppelin, Jeff was pretty underground. Because, I mean, especially when he went instrumental, it's not so mainstream as the other bands. In fact, I remember I befriended this guy in a record shop, and he had a Jeff Beck promo for the There and Back record, this cardboard cutout that I still have, and I just begged it off him. I go, you have to give that to me. You know, and I just collected stuff. In fact, I remember staying up one night. He was doing promo for the Flash record, and it was advertised for a week. We're going to have an interview with Jeff Beck. And I just made sure I was home. I had to be home. And I was in this apartment with no bed, just sleeping on the floor, but I had my radio.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that is so special and such great memories
that
to... Gosh, I never imagined in a million years that I would end up in his band. On the Bad Tour, Rory Kaplan was one of the keyboard players, and I was talking about Jeff Beck at one point, and he said, yeah, I worked for Jeff and Jan on one of the tours, and I'll introduce you. Well, it never happened. So I thought, son of a bitch. When I got hired for the Dangerous Tour, I knew we were going to England, and I thought, okay, this is my mission of the tour, to meet Jeff.
Yeah.
And so every city that we went to, there was always Sony Epic rep, always reps there, record company reps, hanging out after the show. And I'd ask everybody every night, does anybody know Jeff Beck? Do you know how to get him to a show?
Yeah.
And finally, I got the connection. And he was invited and got VIP tickets in London when we were playing Wembley. And two opening acts went on, and then Michael canceled the show.
Oh, no.
And I thought, oh, God, not why?
Yeah.
I found out that Jeff was turned away at the gate because he showed up kind of late, and they turned him away. And so I called him and said, I don't know when or if they're going to make up the show, but can I meet you anyway? And he was very kind and said, sure, come to the studio tomorrow. He was recording his Rockabilly record.
Yeah.
And so I went there, and that was the Dangerous Tour. My first record had just come out.
Yeah.
And I did a video for Flight of the Bumblebee, and that was aired, and I did a thing for MTV England. So I just got a videotape of that and gave that to him, gave him my CD, made my connection, got my autograph.
Yeah.
Thought I'd never see him again. Checked it off the bucket list. And a couple months later, he called up and said, I finally had a chance to listen to your record properly. Let's do a record together.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Just like, who's this?
Yeah, so I was over the moon. And it was actually 5 years before it happened. And I thought, at that point, he's probably moved on to other things. But it finally happened. And he called me and said, I got a tour of Italy. Let's go. And he had never played with me. He just went. By that time, I had another record out. And he just went on the faith of the two records. And we did a couple months, or maybe a month in Italy, going to all these these wacky venues, because he was had a brand new band and didn't want to do the major mainstream theater venues, and so we did like people's gardens and just some parking lots, just whack ass places to play. But he was smart. It was a really good way to get the band tight. And I ended up with him for 3 years and worked on a couple records, and it was really fun, just so much fun to get to know him as a person. Once the pressure's off and the show's over, he's a comedian, just full on. And there was always two bottles of champagne waiting for us after the show. So it was like a three-year party. By the end of those 3 years, my liver was giving me the finger, so it was chill out after that.
So pretty much after that 2001, when you finished with Jeff Beck, then you did your next solo album, 2007, Whatever.
Yeah.
Was that pretty much your whole time from, like, say, 2001, 2006, or 2007, sorry, getting that happening, like writing songs for it?
Actually, well, funny enough, I was bitching about my first album taking 3 years. Well, my last album took 10 years, and that was my fault. Mostly because I was touring a lot. Yeah. It's just so hard to keep the momentum up when you're out and you come back and you're jet lagged and, you know, you get in the studio and something doesn't work. It's like, I'm going to the movies. I will say that almost all of the stuff that's on the Whatever record was written for Jeff.
Oh, okay.
I spent any time off during those 3 years with Jeff writing tunes and grooves and sending them over. And he used a couple things, but everything else ended up on my record. Watching him work on You Had It Coming, especially, that was all Pro Tools. And it was really interesting watching how the record came together. Basically, he had this great producer, Andy Wright, and a really great drum programmer. And they were in different rooms, and the drum programmer would come up with this groove and send it across the hallway, and Jeff would just react to the groove.
Yeah.
Andy was quick enough that he'd hear immediately, like, that's melodic enough, that's going to be the melody. Chop, 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 chop. And that's how the whole record happened. And so I was super inspired by that and ended up buying my first Pro Tools system after that. So that's how I got into computer recording. But I tell you what, I procrastinated so much the last couple of years. I had made so many tweaks with panning and this and that coming in and out that the thought of tearing that all down and going into another studio to have it mixed was just frightening to me. They're just going to destroy everything because there's no way I can spend the money for a week per song to get it mixed properly.
Yeah.
So I came up with the idea of making really meticulous notes of exactly where this was panned and that was panned and the levels on things. You know, if everything is zero, then this was -2 and this was +3. And so that really helped get a jump start on stuff, but is what it is in the end. You know, the mix is so critical. It's so stressful to be there during the mix. I finally did it after procrastinating for 2 years and it finally came out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And that record too, you know, I started thinking, okay, now it's time to take my own band out. And I just thought of the memories, the negative memories I've had of working with bands in the past and how people show up and don't know the tunes or they're bitching and moaning and complaining and they're expensive and, you know, if nobody shows up to the gig, they still want their money. And so I came up with the idea of playing to tracks but making videos.
Okay.
So people have something to watch besides one person standing up there. And I really got into videos. And so I've been doing that for almost 10 years now. And I've gotten a lot better, and I have a huge variety of imagery for people to watch. Oh, and I tell stories between the songs. And so that's my solo show now.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it's low maintenance. You know, and there's been lots of times where, gosh, in the last few years, I was working with an Italian agent. I got a lot of work in Europe. And it's really hard to book a band and get the amount of money you need every single night. So on nights that he wasn't able to get it, he was still able to book me as a solo act. You know, the band stays here at this hotel, I fly to Spain and do the thing, and so I'm working every day. So it's really come in handy. In fact, this next tour coming up, the very first date is a house concert in Italy. Now, as long as they can rent a PA, I can do the show. It's going to be outdoors, and hopefully the screen won't turn into a sail and fly away.
Oh, fantastic. So, yeah, pretty much the last 10 years you've been doing that, the videos.
Yeah, and I use the videos for clinics, too.
Okay.
it's more entertaining than, you know, just watching somebody there playing and talking.
Yeah. So with your clinics, I want to ask you about, so do you do different ones depending on the levels of people attending them, or you just say, okay, this is it? Like, I mean, do you do like beginner ones, medium or advanced?
No, I don't break it up like that. No. Okay. I try to make it as entertaining and inspiring as I can. Because I know when I go to a clinic, if I walk away inspired, that's worth all the money in the world. There's no way that I could teach different levels. And I've been in those situations where a few times, and it's very frustrating because I know I'm leaving people behind in order to keep things moving and get with other people. So I usually my clinics are sponsored. I mean, I do all kinds of them, but in general, they're sponsored. So if it's for Washburn Guitars, it's pretty much a show, pretty much a solo show, but I talk about the guitar. Okay. Or if it's Digitech Effects, I'll break it down with each song and say, I use this effect, that effect, and here's how I program things. Okay. I've been doing clinics lately for Fishman. I use their Fishman Fluence pickups, but I also use the wireless MIDI system called Triple Play. So that's a whole other thing with, gosh, I have so many songs. I do a horn demo with sax and trumpet, a harmonica thing. I do Stevie Wonder tunes with that. So that whole thing is about sounds. That's very different from my other stuff, although I do make videos for that too. And then two summers ago, I came up with a what I call self-empowerment for the modern musician. It's a four-hour seminar that's just really intense with all these different subjects. Stuff that I wish I was taught in the past. And, you know, School of Hard Knocks, things I've learned along the way, from travel to the Transcribe app to the law of attraction, you know, getting into life philosophy. But I kind of break it down like TED Talks, where it's basically 20 minutes in this segment, jump over to 20 minutes in this. I did it for 2 months, two summers ago. I took my motorhome all around America and did it, and I could never get through all the subjects. So much content. I was studying brain science and trying to get that across and making money from the internet and just a little bit of everything. I'm firing that back up again this year. I have two coming up. But I hope to turn it into a DVD so everybody can buy it online. Yeah. But I've been so busy jumping on planes, I haven't turned it into that yet.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, because you also got the courses, I noticed, on your website too. The was it the 50 Ultra Intervalet course?
I started working for True Fire a couple of years ago. And gosh, they have 250,000 subscribers every month. It's one of the top internet lesson sites out there. And I love the people behind it. It's so fun to go there. They fly me to Florida to shoot the courses. I did one on rock soloing, another one on chord playing, comping, and then the last one was on intervallic licks, because that's one of my specialties. I really got into that when I was at GIT, and I became really enamored with Joe DiOrio, jazz guitarist. So I got into that. Intervallics in a rock format, where there's a lot of string bending and string skipping and jumping. And the next one I got, that's been done for well over a year, and they've been reconstructing the place in Florida, so I haven't gone there. But it's going to be Jeff Beck licks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so once you're in the system, they want you to keep coming up with more and more stuff.
Yeah.
So people fired up.
Yeah, I mean, what I saw of that one, looks great, some of the things you got in there. Yeah, even like the pentatonic scale, getting into different type of things in there as well, and string skipping. Yeah, it looks excellent.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had a lot of students say, I know the pentatonic scale, but I want to get beyond that because I've mastered it. Hold on. There's a whole lot you can do with the pentatonic scale that is way beyond what you're doing now. And string skipping, doing wide intervallic jumps is one of them.
That's good.
So who knows what's going to be next?
Yeah. Also, I saw in October you're doing a Navi UK Michael Jackson tribute show? So what's that about?
Yeah, you know, I've turned down tribute shows for many years, especially right after Michael died. They were just coming out of the woodwork, you know, people trying to make money off of Michael.
Yeah.
But and I had turned Navi down before, but I don't know, it just was a time in my life I was ready to check it out. Hmm. And it turns out he's got really great players. Okay. So it's funky. Yeah. And I've done a few tribute things in Europe that the worst part of it is they're not funky. Mm. You know, they might be playing the parts, but they don't have the feel, and it just is borderline embarrassing, some of them.
Yeah.
But Navi, I really like him as a person.
Yeah.
The band is great, so it's just fun. I guest on 5 or 6 songs, and we travel around UK, and he's hoping to break out into Europe soon, and so we'll see. I got my third tour with him coming up in a couple months.
Okay. Oh, so you've done it before.
Yeah. I really dig it, and I mean, it gets me over the pond, so yeah. I always add a lot of other stuff. I think I'm only with him for 16, 17 shows this time,
but
I got a lot of other stuff coming up. I'm supposed to go to Russia for a guitar festival, unless Donald Trump screws up. I would not be surprised if Putin just shut off all American visas altogether. It's such a wreck here, I can't even tell you.
Yeah.
So that might not happen. And I've been going to Poland for 5, 6 years now and playing with a band every year for 2 weeks.
Mm.
So I'll be going back doing that and various things all over Europe.
Oh, that's excellent. So now with the, I know we spoke about it before, but the new project you got going comes out September 22nd.
Yeah.
Again, that will be available on your site. People can go to that.
Sure, yeah. It'll be on iTunes, Amazon, well, I suppose all the major digital distribution centers. But yeah, you'll be able to, well, I was going to say you will be able to buy CDs from my site, but I haven't even organized that yet. I don't know. In fact, the singer and I were just talking about having those download cards when you tour. Because I just can't take CDs. My luggage is maxed out when I travel, so I can't even sell CDs, but I could bring some of those little...
Yeah.
Digital download cards.
Yeah, seems the way to go these days.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. I get nailed for excess luggage. It's such a pain.
Yeah. So no plans of coming to Australia?
I don't. I'd like to.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Navi has been talking about going there, but there's nothing confirmed yet.
Mm.
It's possible 2018 will bring me there, but we'll see.
Okay. Yeah, I know there is a show here, the King of Pop, I think it's called, TJ. I've actually played with him. He's a drummer, but he does the whole Michael Jackson thing. And yeah, really good job. It's fantastic.
Cool. Yeah. I know one of the guys. Is there two main guys there? Or is
he's the only one I know of.
So you're saying he's the drummer?
No, he plays Michael. But he's
the...
I played okay. I did a gig with him once. He played drums.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. So hopefully you might be able to check that out if you come down.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah. Now, just before we go, I just want to find out, just a bit with your guitar playing, do you have a favorite exercise that you like to show people or you like to do yourself?
I'll go through some exercises that I do.
Yep.
There was a period of time where I was super frustrated that I wasn't fast. So like everybody, the Al Di Meola era, everybody was just blazing and I wasn't.
Mm.
So I set out specifically to... deal with speed.
Okay.
And I did this thing real methodically where, like now you do it on the laptop, but back then I had an accounting book where I had a white line, blue line, white line all the way down, lines this way, lines that way. And so I would write down every exercise that I would do, scale patterns like thirds. And I would do it to a metronome. If I made a mistake, I'd back it down, make it slower until I could do it perfectly. And I would do it on every fret from the third up to the 12th. Mm. And then I would start with the next mode, next fingering. I mean, it took hours to get through the whole thing.
Yeah.
Then like, maybe triplets. Yeah, all of a sudden when you do triplets, you automatically slow down because it's a little detainment in the right hand. And I would do... like groups of four, and again doing thirds is automatically slow down, and then I would do every interval too, diatonic force, fifths, and the bigger the jump, the slower it is. Sixths, sevenths are pretty tough. and that up to octaves. And to do that, all that I just did from the 3rd fret to the 12th fret will take a little bit of time. And I write down the metronome marking. I could do that fastest every day. And boy, I tell you, within 2 months, I could see the progress. And usually when you're improving as a musician, you don't really realize it. You just, you always want to be here, wherever you are. You want to be there, you're always reaching for something beyond where you're at. But when you do something methodical like that, it's just phenomenally helpful and encouraging. And of course, you're going to plateau at certain spots where you don't get faster because physically it's just not going to happen. And playing a lot will automatically do it because you're in a different consciousness when you're performing. And I think everybody can get an extra 10% when you have that adrenaline running and you've got the audience there expecting stuff from you. I remember Pat Metheny, when I was at GIT, I was reading everybody's articles that came out, and he said he never practiced anymore. And I was just horrified. Like, how could you not practice? You're a guitar player. But he's doing 300 dates a year. And he said he thought his chops always sucked, and then they didn't. You know, it's just the gradual improvement. All of a sudden, you can do everything you think you want to do on stick. So, I mean, I'll go through all that stuff, and then I'll do arpeggios. Like, say, if I was doing minor arpeggios, I might do them like A minor 7, D minor 7, G, all the ones that you can do in the same spot. And that really helped open up the neck so that I could play over chord changes without having to go, let's see, I know an A minor here, and then jump up here with E minor down here. So trying to be as economical as possible and do everything without moving more than one fret one way or another, no matter what song you're playing through, that really helped open up the fretboard for me.
That's good. It opens up the whole neck.
Yeah, it does. It's funny, I've been playing, well, since I was 8 years old, but especially since I went to guitar school, graduated in 79, I'll say in the last maybe 6-7 years, I've noticed another huge bump. And, you know, it's like the layers of an onion just open up and you can see things more clearly. And all of a sudden I'm doing things and seeing things that I couldn't see before, or what, you know, kind of gray areas clearing up. That's just from playing and just trying to break out of patterns that you normally do just because you get bored with yourself. I've done this 5 million times. All right, it's on that record. I don't want to be doing that again. Just forcing yourself to see things in a different way is really helpful. Other than that, I'll do some meaningless exercises, like all the combinations of four fingers all the way across the neck. 1, 3, 2, 4.
Yeah, so I've actually got a sheet of that. It's called No Laughing Matter. It was in one of the guitar player magazines, I think. And it covers all those, the 24 different combinations.
And
so that's something I give my students and say, do that all the way down the fretboard. It may take 20 minutes, but it's a good little exercise.
It's really helpful because some of them are trickier than you think. You think, oh, it's just four fingers and it's always down, up, down, up, down, up. But right now, I haven't done it in a really long time, but like 3-2-4-1 is just kind of awkward for me. And forcing yourself into those awkward things will just, it's like the heavy bat method where it just makes things easier once you jump on stage.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, once you've done that scale, the whole 24, your fingers are ready to go. You can play anything. I don't play anything, but you can at least feel more comfortable on the guitar and, open up all combinations.
And that's the kind of stuff that once you know the patterns, you can do it while you're watching TV.
That's right, and exactly,
It's just like, when I was getting into brain science, the way when somebody learns something new, there's a synapse connection. And over repetition, I think it's when you get to 50 or 60 repetitions, they can physically see growth in the connection. So an analogy would be it starts out as a hair, you know, the size of a hair, and then a string, and then a rope, and then a chain when things really, really nailed. But likewise, if you don't practice, that chain becomes a rope, becomes a string, and gets unconditioned.
Yeah.
That's why you got to keep playing or it goes away.
That's right. That's a good way to put it. No, excellent. So that pretty much wraps up all the questions I wanted to ask you, unless you have any other things you want to say, anyone listening or think any sponsors or anything?
Yeah, actually, well, I will talk about my sponsors. Tell you about this Washburn guitar. This is a relatively new one. I've had only for a year. I had another one that was a signature model that I've used for 20 years, so it was kind of wacky to change, but it's got the coolest neck connection, the Stevens cutaway. So it's very unusual, but it allows you to get up to the 24th fret, and it's the first 24th fret guitar I've ever had easily. So it's super comfortable to get all the way up there. And I'm also using Fishman pickups, which are super quiet. They're active, and it's a, gosh, I've been using Duncan's for decades, so that's a big change for me too. And I've been recording with it, and my recording system for the last year at least, I've had the amp for a couple of years. It's by Blue Guitar, called Amp One, and it weighs under 3 pounds. It's tiny. It's amazing, but it's essentially a vintage 100-watt Marshall with four channels and is MIDI capable, and it's tube driven, so it's like a guitar player's dream. It was developed by a guy named Thomas Blug, who worked for Hughes and Kettner for 20 years. So he's a total Einstein of sound, and he's the kind of guy that can sit there and listen to tubes for 4 hours straight, you know. So I knew him over the years as a really fine guitar player, but I didn't realize that he was a designer also. And when I saw that amp, I go, I gotta have it. So I've had it I had to wait way too long for it, but because he was just getting the company off the ground. But that's what I take with me. I take it in my carry-on. I got my, you know, essentially a Marshall head in my carry-on. Came up with another thing that's Velcroed to the desk, but you can see the picture here. It's called the Blue Box. And what this is impulse responses of 16 different speakers, like Marshall 1965 and 67, Blackstar, NanoCab, and Fender stuff. And also the other knob is a virtual mic placement. So that's all I use to record now. I don't mic anything. I'm really sold on this stuff. I know he's going to keep coming up with phenomenal stuff. So... And there's another, now you got to wait for this. This is kind of fun. There's a new company called Neck Illusions that do graphics for necks. And I just yesterday got my first designs in the mail. Had this design made for the Jackson Tribute. I have 6 designs that will be available soon. And most of the stuff is kind of steampunk. So a couple designers that are just phenomenal. It's been so fun to go, I want this and this in there. So they're essentially stickers.
Yep.
And Steve Vai has some stuff that's going to be put out real soon too. Because he likes to draw and paint. So he's half a dozen of his own original designs. So I got into doing steampunk stuff. I get into these visual art projects, and for 3 years I was really obsessed with doing glass, stained glass and fused glass and all this wax stuff. And then I got into doing steampunk fantasy airships, just the insane stuff. I got a house filled with that stuff. And then you can do promo stuff with it too. So
they can people stick them on the guitar, or just more just stick them anyway?
I suppose you can stick them anywhere, but they're all you know, 22 or 24 separate stickers, because leave room for the frets.
Yeah. Oh, so you can stick them onto the fretboard.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
So I think that's I got my work cut out for me later tonight.
Yeah. That look great.
Yeah. You know, it's I mean, graphics can be insanely expensive.
Yeah.
And graphics on the neck are, you know, it's usually $2,000 inlays. If you want it to be fancy.
Yeah.
So this is something like $20.
Have to try one out.
Yeah. So I'm sure I left out a few things, but that's my main gear. I'm using a Digitech RP1000, using the 4-cable method for effects only, and it's got an expression pedal on it. So I use the whammy pedal a hell of a lot.
Okay.
And I have different banks for different gigs that I do. Like I have a bank just for the Jackson gig. Because most people that do Jackson tributes, if they sing live, they'll take Beat It down at least a D, sometimes C sharp or C.
Yep.
You know, and I fly around the world with one guitar. So I use, it's called the drop pedal.
Okay.
So I can set it to C sharp, boom.
And you still play in that open position, or play where you usually play it?
Oh,
yeah. Wow. That's really good.
Yeah, that's a really handy pedal. And I found, oh gosh, so many people do that. And a lot of people in guitar festivals, especially if it's a metal festival, which I don't go to that often, but I have in the past, where half the guitar players are tuned down to E flat.
Yeah, yeah.
And in their mind, they're playing open. I'm going, oh crap, that's just not, you know, transposing up.
Yeah.
Isn't going to sound very good. So I'll break out the drop pedal and instantly take it down a half step.
Oh, and there's no delay or anything?
It's not perfect.
Yeah.
You can tell.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But I'll say that compared to the first whammy pedals, it's come a really long way.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, if I had a preference, it would be to not drop it at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Or have a special guitar tuned down a half step, but you know, I just can't carry a special guitar around the world like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool.
All right, thanks very much. I really appreciate it. And good luck with the new album.
Thanks.
And the new stickers.
Yeah, they're kind of fun.
Yeah.
Okay, all sounds right. Good.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
All right, see you. Bye-bye. I want to quickly thank two sponsors. The first one is Custom Guitar Picks, run by Gus. This is one of the quickest service you'll find for custom-made picks. And you can do it all online. Design your own picks? Just head to customguitarpicks.com.au. There you can select the thickness of your pick, the color, what type of pick you want. You can also upload your own artworks, then submit it online, and it's all done. You can also check out the different categories of other picks to choose from. The other sponsor is Guitar World, run by Mick. Guitar World used to be a shop in the High Street, Northcote. Now Mick is concentrating on repairs, services and setups. So Mick has been doing all my services for the past 20 years on all my guitars, and every time I get it back, it feels like a brand new guitar. So call Mick on 0476 937 025. Also, don't forget to head on over to my website, becomeaguitaristtoday.com. I have some new packages on the website, from $5 to $40. Also, please don't forget to rate, review, and share this podcast. And you can also download all the other podcasts. So, until next week, keep jamming.